From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a rather controversial post about disability. It comes from someone who has built a respected career in Rochester. Stephanie Woodward has been a longtime advocate for disability rights, and until recently, she was director of advocacy at the Center for Disability Rights. Woodward is critical of the idea that society needs to find a cure for disabilities. She has spina bifida, and so she might have been surprised when the Spina Bifida Association asked her to write a piece about her views on having spina bifida and the things that bother her. Woodward writes, quote, "You see, because I love my disability identity, I have never seen my disability as a problem. And because I have never seen my disability as a problem, I have never supported curing spina bifida or even preventing it. In fact, when I hear someone say, 'I think the world would be a better place if we could prevent babies from having your disability in the future,' what I hear is, 'I think the world would be a better place without people like you.' Now, people usually respond to this by asking me why I would want future generations to suffer. My answer is, I don't. I don't want anyone to suffer. I don't believe that having spina bifida is equivalent to suffering. I'm 31 years old, and I am living a very happy life. Yes, I have had more surgeries than I can count, but I haven't suffered. And yes, I know that others with spina bifida have had a different experience than me, and I understand that some have experienced pain. I am very supportive of medical advancements to address pain, but there is a big difference between addressing pain and eliminating disability. I believe that there is a place in our world for disabled people. People with disabilities are not broken versions of non-disabled people who should be prevented or cured, no more than women are lesser versions of men. Disabled people are people. We are valuable people, and we should not be eradicated." End quote. Well, that piece sparked a variety of responses, some cheering the sentiment. Others disagreed, offering their own view of what it means to search for a cure and to acknowledge their own challenges. And we've asked Stephanie Woodward to join us to further discuss her views. She's now a crime victims attorney at the Empire Justice Center, and it's great to have you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And a brief hello from our colleague Jean Fisher on this final day of our fall membership campaign. Hello.
Hello, and I promise to keep it brief because this sounds like such a fascinating conversation that's coming up, and I will be glued to my own radio in just a couple of minutes. But right now, I do want to ask you, as the listener, to think about what it takes to make this kind of discussion possible. If you flip around the radio dial right now, and don't do it right now because you want to hear this, you're not going to find this kind of thoughtful, in-depth, civil discussion about such an important issue other than right here on your public radio station. So I'd like to urge you to take just a moment to go to the phone, dial 585-454-6300, or you can go online to wxxinews.org or to weos.org if you're listening to our sister station, WEOS in Geneva, or perhaps you're listening on different radio, you can go to WRUR.org. Make a financial contribution to help foot the bill for the programming you depend on here on your public radio station. And when you do it in this next hour, your pledge, no matter what, will be doubled thanks to a challenge grant in memory of Faye Fondler, and that is going on until 2 o'clock this afternoon, so you can make your dollars go twice as far in support of your public radio station, help foot the bill for wonderful, accurate, thoughtful programming, foot the bill for Connections with Evan Dawson, and keep public radio strong for generations to come. Once again, if you want to talk with one of our volunteers, the number is 585-454-6300. And thank you for supporting your public radio station.
All right, Jean Fisher, thank you so much. Well, Stephanie Woodward, when you say, quote, "I love my disability in the same way that I love being a woman," end quote, tell me more about that.
I think that my disability is just as much a part of my identity as my womanhood is. I don't view my disability as separate from myself. So in the disability community, there is this debate on language, whether to be called a person with a disability or a disabled person. And people who choose to be called a person with a disability say, "I want to be viewed as a person first, because my disability is not all of me. It is a part of me." And then people who choose to be called a disabled person really view disability as an integral part of who they are. They say, like, "My disability is not an accessory that I take off. It's not something with me. It's who I am." And that's very much how I see myself. I also don't say that, like, I'm a person with woman parts, right? Or a person with womanhood. I am a woman, and that is how I identify. I think that for me, you separate yourself from something you view as a negative, and I don't want to separate myself from my disability identity because I don't view it as a negative. I view it very positive, just like I view being a woman as very positive.
Do you try to sway people who take that other approach of saying, I am someone with a disability? Do you try to sway them into thinking differently about it?
I don't know that I try to sway them, but I do try to instill disability pride in anyone that I meet because we live in a world where disability pride is not celebrated. We live in a very ableist society where oftentimes people with disabilities are either born into families where they have parents that don't have disabilities, so they don't understand disability identity and oftentimes raise their children to believe that there's something that needs to be fixed about them, or they acquire their disability. So they've gone their entire lives being non-disabled, and then they acquire their disability, so they think that they need to be fixed to go back to that non-disabled identity. So sometimes it does take that conversation. And I can tell you that when I was younger, I did think that there was something wrong with me because so many people would approach me and ask, what's wrong with you? And when people ask you that enough times, you start to believe it.
If we could, let's kind of go back then through back to the beginning of Stephanie, if we could. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Greece, New York. So, right 5 minutes up the road.
And your diagnosis of spina bifida, I told Stephanie before the hour began, I'm very ignorant about it, tried to read a little bit about it. And her response to that was very interesting, which we'll get to in a moment. But what did you know about spina bifida growing up? When did you know you had it and what it was?
So my parents were very good about keeping me involved with my doctor's appointments, keeping me involved in the conversations. But I think it's important to recognize that my parents were both people who didn't graduate high school. So their involvement in the conversations was limited, because they didn't always know all the questions to ask. So I knew I had spina bifida, but if you ask me right now what level of spina bifida I have, I couldn't tell you, and I just don't care because I don't think diagnosis matters as much as my societal needs. I know I need a wheelchair. So meeting my needs in the community matters a lot more to me than medical terms.
When you were growing up, have you... And here's where I want to learn as much as I can from you about use of language. So how do you describe your wheelchair? You know, one thing that I'm sure you don't say is confined to a wheelchair, which is a super offensive, I'm sure, way of describing it. But how do you describe the wheelchair? You're someone who uses a wheelchair, has a wheelchair.
I'm a wheelchair user. That's my wheelchair. That's how I would describe it. I would never say I'm confined to it. I also don't call myself a wheelchair. There's lots of people in the world who call wheelchair users wheelchairs, and I think that that's very interesting.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
So if you're in a crowd, they'll say, okay, people over here, wheelchairs over there. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Oh,
so
I
where
see.
Should I go? Do you want me to separate from my wheelchair? Because last I checked, I'm still a human. Sitting in my wheelchair. So and also, why are we segregating wheelchair users from quote unquote people?
Yeah, okay, fair. When did you start using a wheelchair?
So I've always used wheelchairs on and off from surgeries. I would describe my childhood as I probably should have used a wheelchair a lot sooner. But my dad was the kind of guy who would just carry me on his shoulders for a prolonged period of time. And I thought that's just what kids do. But he probably carried me a lot longer than he should have and injured his shoulders because I was probably a heavy kid at 10 years old. But I started using a wheelchair more fuller time around 12.
Around 12.
Yeah.
And what did you think of it at the time?
You know, I'm going to be really honest with you. My dad really suggested I get a wheelchair when he saw me in middle school. I started going to the mall with my friends, and he saw I couldn't keep up with my friends around the mall. It was just really exhausting for me, and he wanted me to have a social life. So he said, you know, we really should get you a power wheelchair scooter. It'll be fun. You can keep up with your friends. And I said, you know, I would consider a scooter, but not a power wheelchair. And he said, well, why wouldn't you consider a wheelchair? And I said, I don't want people to think I'm disabled. And he said, I have news for you, kid. You are disabled. And if you're going to let what other people think of you stop you from getting what you need to live a better life, then you can do that, but that's only going to negatively impact you. So you need to decide the kind of person you want to be.
That's a powerful message from Dad.
Yeah, it was. It was really, it's very interesting. He, I think, really tried to be the best dad he could be for a disabled child that he didn't know what to do with, right? Because it can be very frightening to be a non-disabled person with a limited education, having a disabled child and not knowing what to do. So he did the best he could, really teaching me to be proud of my identity and eventually letting me choose whether or not I wanted to seek cure treatments or just live the life I wanted to live. And I started coming to the realization around 11 or 12, like, if I didn't have my disability, I wouldn't be who I am. So why would I want to be able to walk, quote unquote, normal? And he was like, yeah, you're right. If you don't want to do that, then let's not do that.
Yeah. Coming up, I'll read some of the feedback to your piece, which, you know, had different reactions and different perspectives. But there is something different about the idea that someone with a disability would, quote unquote, choose to live with it or try to, quote, overcome it, which is some of the language you hear, versus embrace it as part of the identity. Do you feel like it really was at 11 or 12, or were you older when you could wake up and say, I love who I am in every way and I wouldn't change it?
I think it was much older when I said, I love who I am and I wouldn't change it. And there's this great poem in the disability community where a line is, you get proud by practicing. And I think that that's really important for all marginalized communities because there's internalization of these isms, right? So internalized ableism is very real. When the world asks you every day what's wrong with you, you do start to believe there's something wrong with you. And you, it takes a long time to unlearn that. So there are some days that I could still wake up and wonder, like, am I a burden? Then I have to, like, shake myself and be like, no, I'm not a burden. Forget that idea. Like, this is who I am. And if someone has an issue with that, like, that's on them. That's not on me.
Define ableism. It's come up a couple of times.
So ableism is an idea that a person with a disability is inherently less than someone without a disability because of their disability.
And, you know, you thought about at 11 or 12, I don't know if I want a motorized wheelchair because I don't want my friends to think I have a disability. Yeah, kids are always thinking about, you know, we're human beings. We think about social reactions. We think about what our friends think. What did your friends think? How did that go for you?
It was actually really great. The friend circle that I had was really embracing of it. Let's be honest, by the time I got it delivered, I was 12 years old and a bunch of preteen girls seeing a motorized wheelchair. We used it as a toy. Let's be all very honest. Like, do you know how many preteen girls can fit on a power wheelchair and roll it down the street to Wegmans? 4. That's the answer.
Can I laugh at this?
It's amazing. And so it's really great to see how that has evolved, because now I have nieces and nephews that ask for wheelchairs for Christmas because they have grown up with an aunt that has seen, like, they have seen me in my wheelchair, and they have only known that that is the coolest and normalest thing to have in their life. And they come over my house and ask, can I play with wheelchairs? Where's the wheelchair?
What do you say?
I say, yeah, well, if you want to play with the power ones, we go outside because you've started crashing into the walls now. So the power ones we go outside to play with. But if they want to play with manual wheelchairs, we can play inside. And the rule is if you flip backwards and you hit your head, there is no crying. So that's the rule. But they are really embracing of the idea. I remember picking up my niece for school when she was like 4 or 5, and I had a scratchy throat, and it was the first time I'd ever picked her up from preschool, and I signed in to get her, and I said, oh, hi, Charlie, I'm here to pick you up. And her friend had said, oh, what's wrong with your aunt? And Charlie, without even a second thought, goes, oh, she just has a cold. And her friend said, oh, okay. And we just laughed, and I knew the question was about my wheelchair, and it didn't even occur to Charlie that the question would be about my wheelchair. She immediately went to, I have a cold. And that is exactly the kind of world that I want to live in.
That's awesome. Now, the point about your friends and nieces and nephews playing with the wheelchair sounds to me like an extension of the lesson that I learned from Stephanie maybe a year ago, which is we were talking about how when you are in public spaces, you'll often see doors that have an option of a wheelchair entry. You know, press a button, the door opens. And I was explaining that, you know, my son at the time, who's now 7, you know, before 5, he'd press it. And I thought, should I tell him not to? Because he doesn't use a wheelchair. Is it inappropriate for him to do that? And Stephanie was like, no, let him do that. That's fine. That's cool. And that just says to him that that's just part of the world. That's right.
We all can have access. And if you tell someone that they can't be a part of the disability access, you're kind of teaching them that there's something different, bad, and taboo about it, when in fact, there's nothing. Like, everybody loves buttons. Like, let's touch all of the buttons. And if you learn that, like, disabled people get more buttons, then, like, maybe kids will want to hang out with us more. And that really, you learn from a young age about diversity and integration. So studies have shown kids that grow up around other disabled people are less likely to discriminate as adults. So if we can even get those ideas in through using the wheelchair labeled buttons, then let's start somewhere.
Were there hard parts? Has there been a hardest part for you?
Of course there's hard parts.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember being little and wondering if anybody would ever love me when I'm grown up, because I overheard adult conversations, right? And adults are much crueler than children ever were. So overhearing adults talk to my parents and say, well, she'll never get married because, I mean, look at her. These were the things that I overheard, or I specifically remember a case in Canada where a man killed his daughter who had a disability, and his daughter had CP, but when the news broadcaster described her, she sounded very much like me. She had limited mobility, bladder and bowel sounded similar to when I was around 7 or 8. Everything sounded similar, and I remember overhearing some women talking to my mom saying, well, I could understand where the father killed her. It must have been such a burden to have a disabled child. And I remember wondering, like, will my mom kill me? And they said, well, like, obviously he loved her. He killed her out of love. And I'm like, oh, gosh, my mom loves me. What if my parents kill me out of love? Like, that's a really scary thing to grow up and have to wonder for, like, and I wondered for a long time.
What do you think now of this idea that a parent could murder a child out of love?
I mean, I've obviously learned since then. The reason I remember learning is this is going to sound very silly. After that, I threw funerals for myself in my room for a while, because I was convinced that if I was going to die, I had to, like, really be prepared for it.
Wow. How old were you?
I was about 7 or 8. I had my stuffed animals that would all, like, have eulogies for me. I had a very active imagination. And I remember that it was my mom who had, like, walked in and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm having a funeral in case you ever kill me. And she, like, was like, what are you talking about? And so I had explained, like, the girl on TV, and she's like, I was like, the dad, he killed her because he loved her. And she's like, oh, no, no, honey, no, he did not kill her because he, like, that's not love. And she had to, like, explain to me, like, that's not what parents do when they love their kids. And that's not, like, the news shouldn't have said that. Like, her friends shouldn't have said that. But for me, like, that's still a memory that is very vivid in my head. And it's still something I see on the news to this day.
Yeah. And we've talked about it on this program with local stories in which, a parent has killed a child. Is that issue entirely over for you? I mean, do you think now there's obviously no justification for killing a child. Can you empathize at all with that mindset?
No. I could never, ever justify or empathize with the idea that it would be okay to kill anyone, and period, but certainly not say, well, it's okay because they're disabled.
Take away the physical violence, the frustration or the burnout that parents claim to feel at times. I don't say claim to feel. I want to honor what people say they are feeling. When parents say they sometimes can feel that,
I think all parents feel burnout. Absolutely. And I'm sure that parents with the children of disabilities feel burnout. And I think that there are certainly ways that you can address that without murdering people.
Now, when we talk about your feelings on disability, I said at the outset, you might have been surprised that the Spina Bifida Association asked you to contribute a little piece on it, just because it is different than some advocate or express. Were you surprised that they said, sure, let's do this?
I was really surprised because I know that my position is different than theirs and from most people. Many people, I wouldn't say most people, because a lot of younger people with spina bifida are changing perceptions and do share my views. So, but there are a lot of people who are not young millennials that have disability pride identities. So when they reached out to me after I've been pretty vocal about my opinion, and they said, hey, you have a different opinion.
You've been critical.
Oh, very openly.
Mostly stemming from what? Language about a cure?
Cure language specifically, and a lot of I'm opposed to money going towards prevention efforts rather than going towards quality of life efforts, because I think it's very important to look at research to improve the quality of life of people with disabilities rather than prevent disabilities from occurring.
So first of all, credit to them for saying, we may disagree with you, but we want to hear your views and we want to air them.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah, good for them. Now, did you know that expressing it the way you feel on this kind of a venue could lead to some criticism?
Absolutely. I mean, my opinion is different than the majority of what parents feel all of the time. Most parents want a cure or prevention for their child. So I had no doubt that parents would feel different. And I know that there are plenty of people with spina bifida that would feel different than me, and that's okay. I mean, I'm not here to change your mind about how you feel about yourself, but I do hope that future generations will embrace their identity and feel some sort of pride rather than feel like they're a burden.
Can I read a little bit more from your piece?
Sure.
So here's some more of what Stephanie Woodward wrote for the Spina Bifida Association earlier this month. Quote, I regularly hear people with spina bifida talk about how their spina bifida didn't stop them. And that phrase always confuses me. Of course, spina bifida doesn't stop us. Our disability isn't a conniving monster dead set on bringing us down. At least that's never how I viewed spina bifida. End quote. So let's talk a little bit about that. When people say, spina bifida didn't stop me, if they were to say to you, look, you know what I mean. I mean, there are certain limitations I may have, and why is it a problem to say that? Be specific. What bothers you about spina bifida didn't stop me?
What bothers me is we're focusing on the wrong thing. What you mean to say is the discrimination I experienced in society didn't stop me. I don't think that anyone thinks that their disability is really what is stopping them, because I don't believe there's anything about the diagnosis of spina bifida or any other disability that is actually stopping people. I think it is the discrimination and the inaccessibility in society that is stopping people. So people are like, my spina bifida didn't stop me from getting a job. Why would spina bifida stop you from getting a job? Like, you're still completely capable of getting a job. What in the world would make you think that you're not, except for the world telling you? Maybe it's teachers that told you you weren't capable. Maybe it's employers that told you that they don't take people like you. But that's not your disability. That is the world that is at fault. That is not on you.
So you want people who would make those kind of comments to turn their gaze outward to society as opposed to inward about what they perceive to be potentially their own limitations?
Yeah, I think it's very much like if someone said, well, being a woman didn't stop me from becoming CEO. Why would being a woman stop you from being CEO? It's not about your identity. It's about society putting the limitations out there. It's not about your identity. So I really think that we need to look at fixing society rather than looking at the individual and saying that there's something wrong with the individual that needs to be fixed. And we need to really look at what is wrong with the world that needs to be fixed.
Continuing in a piece, the next paragraph from Stephanie kind of further elucidates this. You say, like being a woman, being disabled means that I experience discrimination and other hardships, but that's not my fault or my disability's fault. That's society's fault and a problem for society to fix. I don't think that my life would be better if I was non-disabled, but I do think my life would be better if the world were less discriminatory and more accessible, end quote. As I mentioned, I'll read some of the feedback that have come in coming up here, but you are firm and confident now that your life is, you love your life and it would not be better if you were non-disabled.
I think my life would be worse if I was non-disabled. I'm going to be very honest with you. I come from a family that generally doesn't go to higher education, and I went to law school. Like, I went far above and beyond higher education, and I did that because I have a disability. I specifically went to law school to study disability rights law. I don't think I would have done this if I didn't have a disability. I genuinely believe that I probably would have stopped at high school, just like many people in my family have done, because that's the expectation. My father put higher expectations on me because I have a disability, and I held myself to them.
And so when you say that it's society's fault that people, for example, with spina bifida, think about themselves as limited, that's society's fault, not their disability, not their fault. And it's a problem for society to fix. We are not very probably deep into the solutions business yet. I mean, I'm sure there's been progress. There's no question there's been progress. And frankly, people in all communities across the country, people like you have been helping lead that progress. But give me a sense for how far along you think we are in terms of the progress for society to fix this.
I think that we have a long way to go for society to fix this. I mean, the unemployment rate of people with disabilities is significantly high. The pay rate of people with disabilities who are employed is lower than the pay rate of people without disabilities that are employed. So there is discrimination even within people who are employed. When we're looking at implicit bias, studies have been done that over 70% of people have an implicit bias against people with disabilities. So there's a lot that needs to be done. So people can say, oh no, I totally accept disabled people, and still discriminate against disabled people and still make us feel like we're not wanted in that space. So there's a lot of work that can be done. There's restaurants that are inaccessible, and they say, well, like, that doesn't mean we don't like disabled people. It just means that, like, we have a step to get in. Okay, well, your step to get in says you don't want me here. So that does speak volumes.
Well, we recently had a really lovely conversation with Oscar Bond, Oscar is what, 10 years old, Megan Mack? 11. This amazing and, yes, inspiring young guy who has laid down a clear marker earlier in that conversation. Do not tell me that I'm inspiring to you just because I exist. He talked about things people say, you know, out in public. I'll pray for you. You know, you're so inspiring. Inspiring why? You don't even know me. I'm just moving through the world in a wheelchair. I think he's inspiring because he is one of the most impressive, dynamic, speaking and thinking 10-year-olds I've ever met from any background. And I can't even imagine what I was doing at 10. So Oscar, that's why I think you're inspiring. But I hear you, dude. Now listen, Oscar's going to say, you know, don't put the inspiring part in just being, and don't say, I'll pray for you. Have you heard that? I'll pray for you.
I have heard that a million times in my life, and it has taken me a while to really confront this. So now I ask people, like, when they tell me, I'll pray for you, I tell them, okay, $227,000. And they say, what? And I said, that is the amount of my student loans right now. Is that what we're praying for? And they get very confused. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you just offered to pray for me. Like, don't I get to choose the prayer? Like, because otherwise I don't want your unsolicited prayers. I think that it is incredibly rude for you to come up to me and decide for me what I want. Like, I think that is absolutely so, like, inappropriate. And yet I get it all of the time.
So help people who are hearing this understand your perspective when they might say in response, okay, but come on, they mean well. They mean well.
Meaning well, there's a completely different intention, the difference between intention and impact. I don't care what you mean. What you are doing has a different impact. So I'm not sure how many words are allowed to be used on this show, but there's a great saying that the path to that bad place that's the opposite of heaven.
Oh, you can say hell.
Oh, right. I can say. I don't know what's allowed to speak.
Path to hell is paved
with
good
intentions.
Yeah.
So your great intentions is bringing you straight to hell then, because I don't need your prayers. And what you're telling me is that you feel that I'm not whole. And that is really problematic because I am completely whole. I am not broken. I don't need to be fixed. And who are you, a person that has never met me, to decide to come up to me and offer me your unsolicited prayers? Like, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm living a pretty great life. Like, I have a house. I have four cats that, like, run my life. I'm getting married to a pretty great guy. Like, what in the world would I need your prayers for? And another one that people think is, well, really good intentions is, you're so brave. Brave for what? So I start asking, brave for what? Brave for living with your disability. What was my other option? And they're like, well, you know, what I mean is I could never live like that. What you mean is you would rather be dead than live like me? Is that a compliment? You mean well by saying I'm brave, but what you really mean to say is you would rather be dead than live like me. Let's talk about intentions when you think about that, because I don't hear anything good out of that. What I hear is you think that my life isn't worth living.
And now you're at the point where if they say you're so brave or I'll pray for you, you do sort of challenge it back?
Oh, absolutely. Every single time. I think that people really need to think about what they're saying and how it impacts people. Because I'm 31 now. I can take this and I can discuss it. But there's a 5-year-old out there who is going to be hearing these words for decades and really struggling with their identity because of it.
Brave for living with a disability. I hear you when you say that the intention is not really what matters here. What matters is the impact.
Absolutely.
Talking to Stephanie Woodward, who is joining us to talk about her recent writing for the Spina Bifida Association. And she is someone in our community. You might have seen her face, for example, on the news. She spent a lot of time lobbying, doing policy work, advocacy, and sometimes being arrested and hauled out of places by security, which was, by the way, the most famous incident. That was that outside McConnell's office? Where was that?
That was McConnell's office, and those were Capitol Police.
Capitol Police.
Much higher than security.
Okay. Thank you for the correction. Capitol Police carried you out.
Yes, they did. Apparently the wheelchair wasn't good enough.
Don't make me laugh at this, see? Stephanie's here because she is funny, and she is a remarkable leader in our community who is now a crime victims attorney at the Empire Justice Center. And we're talking about her perspective on disability, an ableist society, and what change looks like for that society. But she's also asking anyone with a disability to kind of cast their gaze out at society that has to change, as opposed to asking them to change. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we sit down with candidates for Monroe County Court Judge, a chance to hear from the candidates in this judicial race for an extended time, asking our questions and yours. In our second hour, are discussions about climate change too focused on partisan issues? A group called Sea Change says the issue is nonpartisan, and they're leading workshops that are promoting science. We talk with them when they're in Rochester on Monday. So what I want to do is work through some of the feedback that Stephanie Woodward got, and I think your response, I think, will be instructive, because you're not only writing this the piece for the Spina Bifida Association as someone who has spina bifida, but also you have a lot of expertise in advocacy. You're obviously a phenomenal communicator, and you heard from plenty of people who were loving what you wrote. And let me just read a few of those. Michelle writes, I'm 51 years old and definitely not suffering or bitter about being born with spina bifida. We have shown the medical world that despite given grim odds at birth, we have overcome those odds and become very independent individuals. I'm an aunt to four beautiful nieces and four precious nephews who don't even think about the chair. And when they do have questions or comments, I answer them very honestly. I wouldn't want my journey to be any other way so far. Loving this life God has given me. Heidi says, I'm now 50 years young and a married woman with two children. I am not disabled. I am able to do almost everything I want. I wanted to live a normal family life with children, so I did. I educated, but I never got a job. I have had too many surgeries and I live with too much pain. I will still try to have a good life, and I don't hate having spina bifida. It could have been worse. And there were a number of responses like that, which I suspect is affirming. You know, is it interesting for you to hear feedback from all corners and backgrounds?
I mean, I think it's interesting, but I also live by the number one rule in life, which is never read the comments.
Oh, man. You haven't read any of these?
I think I've read the ones where some people who were really affirmed by what I wrote tagged me when they shared it and said, thank you so much, Stephanie, for like saying these words, like, this is what I needed. So I got to see that. And I think that, like, I saw a few that said, like, I disagree completely. My life is terrible. And I'm like, oh, well, God, you really should seek some therapy.
Well, let me read the harshest on this, because, frankly, the comment I'm about to read stopped me in my tracks.
Okay.
It's hard to think about this. But a woman named Natalie writes, I make the best of what I have, but if I could go back and my parents knew I had spina bifida in the womb, I'd certainly want to be aborted, knowing what I know now. A lot of people say they are proud of who spina bifida made them. I'm not. It's made me bitter, angry, tired, paranoid, lonely, non-trusting. I miss who I was before I understood how the world saw me. That's really hard to hear. What would you say to Natalie?
I think what's really illuminating is the very last line. I miss who I was before I knew
how the world saw me.
Exactly. So do you hear what I'm saying now? That it's not the disability. It's the world that's the problem. Because it sounds like to me, she didn't dislike herself until she felt discrimination or ableism from the world. So how I respond to that is I really wish that I knew Natalie. I wish that I could talk to her personally, and maybe I would never change her mind, but maybe we could talk about why she feels that the world's opinion of her matters so much and why that has allowed her to feel like she has a life that's not worth living. Because I really feel like that last line demonstrates so much of what I've been saying, is that disability is not the problem. It is not the medical part of this is not it. It is society making us feel like we don't belong here or we are worthless. And there are some people who really are internalizing that. And it sounds like Natalie has. And I feel terrible that she has, because she said, I know so many people. I think you heard maybe. Can you reread that? I know so many people who are proud of it or who...
Yeah, she says, a lot of people say they are proud of who spina bifida made them. Yeah. I'm not.
So she's saying, like, I know so many, like, a lot of people who are happy, but she's not. So, like, there are so many people who have embraced their disability, or not. She's not one of them because of the way internalized ableism has impacted her. And I really wish that we could get a community to surround her to help her feel more empowered and better about herself, because it sounds like she is not surrounded by a very supportive community.
I think that's a really smart reading of that last line. That's and she's so impacted by what society is telling her that she thinks sometimes it's not even worth being alive. That is a painful and powerful thing.
And it's heartbreaking. And a lot of people with disabilities experience suicidal thoughts and ideation, not because of the disability themselves, but studies have shown it's because of how society has treated them because of their disability. Mm-hmm. And that is why it's so important for society to reflect on their implicit bias against disabled people.
Forgive the ignorance on this question, but this is a serious question. Because I think about someone like Natalie, and the last thing you want anybody from any background thinking is that I wish I didn't exist. And, you know, if we talk about therapy, I'm someone who thinks therapy can be great for a lot of people. Is there specialized therapy for people in the disability community?
I think that this is a really important question. And there was a hashtag going around. I'm trying to remember what it was called. I think it was called My Ableist Therapist. Talking about how hard it is for people with disabilities to find a good therapist, because so many mental health professionals are trained to help specifically with mental health. But the moment you add in other disabilities, it's like they don't know what to do, and they want to blame all mental health issues or disabilities on the other disability, or they don't know how to bring it together as a whole and can be really insensitive. So, for example, I went to see a mental health provider when I was at a really low time in my life, when I was in a bad relationship, things just weren't going well for me. And she was like, well, you know, instead of coming to this office at the University of Rochester where it's fully accessible, you could come to my home. And I said, okay, is your house accessible? She's like, well, there's like two steps to come in. And for me, as a person in a wheelchair coming to seek mental health services, and she knew what I did for a living and everything else, I was like, are you kidding me? And another time I had called my EAP provider to find a mental health provider. They suggested I go to this one person. I got to their office and there was a flight of stairs to get in. And I called them and I said, you didn't tell me you had a flight of stairs. And they said, well, you didn't say you were in a wheelchair. And I'm sorry. At this point, it was like 2017. I was like, it's 27 years since the ADA. Do I really need to tell you your office should be accessible? And for me, like, when disabled people go through so much and finally reach out for help just to be met with ableism, that can break them down even further. So a lot of people who are multiply disabled sometimes hesitate to reach out for help because they don't want to reach out for help and just be met with more discrimination.
Does the disability community keep a list of like, these therapists are cool, and like the rest don't risk it?
I mean, for me, I wasn't able to find a list anywhere. I made a weird video. I made a dating video, basically, and said, hey, I'm Stephanie. Here's all my issues. Who's got a provider for me? And I put it all over social media, which a lot of people wouldn't be able to do. But I was like, I've got some issues. I need to talk to someone. And that's how I was able to eventually find a great mental health provider. But not everybody is able to do that. So, and also, if we did it in Rochester, that wouldn't help somebody elsewhere. So we need to do better. Psychology Today doesn't even have an accessibility option on their little clickies, buttons,
yeah,
check boxes.
Yeah,
I'm not good at technology terms.
But they can do better too.
Yes.
Yeah. No. I'm glad I asked. I mean, it was a super ignorant question, but I think that's really illuminating to hear. And I know people are listening. In fact, here's an email from a doctor who says, I love this segment. As a pediatrician, I spend a lot of time working with teens and children to get them to love themselves as they are and recognize their disabilities, whether physical or learning or intellectual, do not make them less than. One analogy that I've heard and would like your guest's perspective about is this. Having a child with a disability is different, but not inherently bad. It's like booking a flight to LA and then mid-flight, the pilot gets on the speaker and says, folks, we need to stop in Kansas City and we'll be there for a week. Now, KC is not LA, but that doesn't mean KC isn't a great place and that you can't enjoy yourself in KC. It's just a different place. Does that analogy hold water with your guest?
I mean, I've never been to Kansas City, so I can't tell you if it's great.
I was just there. It's awesome.
Is it? Yeah. All right. So maybe it is. I mean, I think that analogy is good. That I think what's really important to me is some parents say that they're mourning the child that they didn't get. Mm. They're like, I was expecting my baby, but what I got was this disabled baby instead. And I'm like, actually, what you got was your baby. Like, what you could have gotten was a non-disabled baby who was a jerk. Let's be honest. But would you be mourning the non-jerk instead? Like, so I think that this doctor has a really good perspective that you didn't get something bad. You didn't, like, lose the lottery here. And losing the lottery just means you're living the same life you got before.
Sure.
So you got something different, but it doesn't mean you got something bad. It means you've got something different. And maybe Kansas City is just as great, but I would hope that you were going to Miami instead, honestly.
let me get on the phone Ben in Auburn. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi. So I just found this author, Leonard Davis. Have you heard of him?
Leonard Davis, no.
No?
He's talking about what you're saying, and I can read a quote that's kind of wordy, but he says the object of disability studies is not the person using the wheelchair or the person who's deaf, but the set of social, historical, economic, and cultural processes that regulate and control the way we think about it and think through the body. And earlier in the book, he gives an example. I'm reading Enforcing Normalcy, about how our reaction is more indicative of what needs to be explored than the person who we've made the word disability to describe.
I think that that's really fair, and I'm glad that you're out there reading disability studies books. That's great.
Yeah, and a good quote, really interesting, and sort of exactly reflects what we've been talking about. But perhaps the most, I don't know, perhaps the most controversial part of what Stephanie wrote is what to some readers thought sounded anti-cure. So let me read one other comment, because I think it's important to get your thoughts on the word cure. Philip writes, I'm sorry, but I disagree with almost all of what she wrote. I'm not ashamed that I have spina bifida, but I'm not happy about it, and I'd never wish for a cure to not be found. I feel certain that walking is better than not walking, running is better than not running, having a straight spine is better than a bent one, and I certainly don't see my disability as a stepping stone rather than a stumbling block. From Philip.
I'd want to talk to Philip about why he thinks that walking is better than not walking. What about walking is better than not walking? And why is running better than not running? So one of the questions I got is, don't you think your life would be better if you could run? And I always answer, there are plenty of people out there who can run who don't. Is their quality of life less than mine? More than mine? And also, I just did a marathon like 2 weeks ago. How many people in the world can physically run but don't do marathons? I would bet that it's a lot. So is it really about the actual running, or is it about the ability to participate in the activity? Because if it's about, I think walking is better because then you can get into restaurants that have steps, then perhaps what you mean is access is better. And you're not upset about the lack of walking, you're upset about the lack of access. So I would really want to get deeper in with him about why is a bent spine better than a straight spine? What is it, pain? Because do we need to address pain? I would really want to dig into deeper why.
Now, on the subject of cure, though, in our last 90 seconds, he thinks it sounds like you're anti-cure, that you don't even want a cure to be found or doctors to research it. How do you feel about it?
I don't think that cures are necessary. I think that we could spend $50 million trying to cure one person, or we could spend $50 million making so many places more accessible for all people. And I think that the quality of life of all people would be improved if we put those $50 million to society to improve it rather than to one individual. I don't think we need cures. I think that people don't need to be able to walk. We need an accessible society. If it's about preventing people from dying, cures to prevent end of life, cures to prevent pain, I think that quality of life cures is different than disability cures.
And I lied. My last question is, in your last 30 to 40 seconds, what are you looking forward to most as a crime victim's attorney at the Empire Justice Center?
I'm really looking forward to being able to help people. Being a victim of crime can be really scary, and there's a lot of different things that you have to do as a result that you shouldn't have to do because you didn't ask to be a victim of crime. So I'm looking forward to being able to take that off of someone else and make that my problem so that they don't have to deal with it.
Just started?
I just started October 1st, so if you're a victim of crime, give me a call. I want to help you.
Stephanie Woodward is an attorney. She's a crime victims attorney at the Empire Justice Center and a figure in our community who's been doing work and advocacy in many different ways for a while and really struck us with this recent piece for the Spina Bifida Association, and you are generous with your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Stephanie Woodward, closing the week for us here on Connections. And we've had a wonderful team helping out on Connections. In fact, I'm going to pull up the full list so I don't miss anybody. Hey, team at WEOS today, Greg Cotterill, Kelly, everyone involved, we love being partners with you. Thanks for the work today at WEOS and Finger Lakes Public Radio. Of course, Emma Ray Stein, our intern. Dolores is the volunteer. Are you interning, Dolores? You're hired. Emma Ray, sorry, you're fired. No, she's the intern, and we love having Emma Ray Stein with us, and Megan Mack is the producer and the engineer today because she's amazing. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.